One other party is in this conference.
Well, I must say this is a poor showing from me. Yes, Saturday at least I had the excuse that I was at an event and dealing with people. But today, why was I not on time? Well, I neglected to set my alarm, believe it or not. I must have been very fatigued, considering that it's a fairly late hour here. But that's where we are at. Anyway, I want to mention that my plan, at least, is to very soon go back to the standard, something resembling a standard schedule. I think what I'm going to wind up doing, because I do have a lot more of this material of nuclear energy conference proceedings and so forth that I would like to get into a read-out form, and this is a real easy way of doing that. But I may wind up doing one pre-recorded, edited, Hear Now the Word show a week, and one live call-in for some time. But that's just a thing to think about. If I can get back up to doing two pre-recorded shows, that'll be great. Let's see. Also, I'm going to be on the actual FM radio in upstate New York again on November 4th. Well, it's November 4th local time in the evening, and I'm not actually sure off the top of my head if that's going to be, you know, 23 hours UTC on November 4th or zero November 5th. Have to work that out. Anyway. But I'm going to finish reading now the statement by Mike McCormick.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And here it is, 19 hours UTC on Saturday, the 11th of March in the glorious future year of 2023. And I am, sadly, a couple of minutes late. I had gone downtown to pick up my mail. Couple of new-to-me simulated nuclear fuel pellet cards to add to my display. One is from Seabrook, New Hampshire. I already had a Seabrook one, but this one is different. So that's at least one station where the public affairs operation wasn't a one and done. And then one from Shoreham. Shoreham is a sad story, if you know about it. Long Island Light Company built a nuclear power plant. It was licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was started up, but it was never allowed to produce power for the public. Went through all the initial function tests, then was shut down, and the fuel was moved to other nuclear power stations to be used there. Why? Well, official hostility. That's simply the reason that some people in New York State government didn't want nuclear power, and they used the excuse that in the case of a major accident, the people in the area on Long Island would have to evacuate through New York City, and so they set it up so that the evacuation plans for Shoreham, which had to be approved by the state government before the State Public Utility Commission would allow the plant to be connected to the grid, were never approved. The whole thing is very, very sad, in my opinion. And, of course, it has the result that even today, as I understand it, on Long Island, much of the electricity that's used comes from diesel. Yeah, diesel. That was the whole idea, was to replace the little onesie-twosie diesel plants scattered across the island with a single big nuclear unit. But no, we can't have nice things. Now, there was an absolutely mind-blowing announcement yesterday from the European Commission, which was that the member states of the European Union are going to cut final energy consumption. That's energy consumption by the end user, that's households, business, and industry, by 11.7% by the year 2030. Now, this is hard to wrap your mind around, folks. They say that it's meant to address the problem of energy insecurity. Well, that's like saying that you're going to address the problem of food insecurity by going on a hunger strike. They say, oh, well, it'll reduce the amount of hydrocarbons we buy from aggressive Russia. Well, the amount of hydrocarbons you buy from aggressive Russia has been going up and up and up and up over the years. You could have taken steps to reduce that at any time, friends. Pardon me if I doubt your newfound sincerity, particularly after the annexation of Crimea and invasion of Donbass 8 years ago. People say, oh, it's the first anniversary of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. No, it isn't. He invaded years ago, and the West did nothing. Because European governments wanted that sweet, sweet Russian oil and gas. But if they really wanted to address the problem, a commitment to double the amount of nuclear power outside in Europe outside France between now and 2030, it probably can be done technologically. And unlike cutting end-user final energy consumption by 11.7%, nearly an eighth, it won't crash anybody's economy. I mean, cutting end-user final energy consumption in Europe by 11.7% is like turning off all the lights in all the households in Europe permanently. It's like turning off all the power in Spain permanently. That's not a trivial thing. I mean, when you think about the European Union, you think, oh, well, you know, France, Germany, they're pretty big countries, right? They'll do okay. You're not thinking about Bulgaria, right? Bulgaria, Romania, these are pretty poor countries. They need to increase their energy consumption in order to raise the standard of living so that people are more likely to be warm in the winter, you know, and have means of getting where they can go. No, reducing final energy consumption. You realize that final energy consumption by the end user didn't fall in the United States during the Great Depression? Yeah, think about that for a minute. The truth is that people in the Great Depression, households, to the extent they could, used more energy. Specifically, all those people who left the Midwest to go to California. How did they get there? They got there in cars. They had to burn a lot of gasoline to do it. No, friends, I don't understand this decision. It makes no sense from a physical standpoint, an economic standpoint, a political standpoint. It certainly does nothing for climate protection. Again, if you want climate protection, you have to provide sources of energy which do what the fossils do and do it better. That's why I'm always harping on nuclear energy. It's the energy part that matters, right? And nuclear does what the fossils do and does it better. It's more compact, its waste products are easier to manage, etc., 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 etc. You know, people say, well, at the same time period as Three Mile Island, there was a much worse radiation accident when a mine tailings dam in New Mexico collapsed. And I'll tell you, it was bad. But what people don't point out is that in 1972, in West Virginia, a coal slurry dam, they take coal slurry and dewater it. Anyway, the coal impoundment, the dam collapsed, and killed well over 100 people. Just washed away villages. So, yeah, practically anything good you can say about the fossil fuels, and there's a lot to like, you can say 10 times or 100 times or a million times more about nuclear energy. But there are people who make it their mission in life to oppose it. And those people get treated as though they have some kind of morally valuable message to hand down to the rest of us. And I don't know why. I can't justify it. I can't explain it. I can't understand it. All I can do is present the opposite view, right? That's about all I can do. I've been thinking about this a lot, that humanity now is possessed of awesome powers. We humans have the ability to change our planetary environment in ways that simply were not possible to the people in the past. And because of our great numbers and because of the scope and reach of our activities, we also find that we are changing the planetary environment in various ways, whether we want to or not. Now, this isn't the first time. There's indications that some of the major environmental changes that happened in the past 100,000 years or so, mass extinctions, changes in vegetation cover because of changes in the grazing and browsing fauna and so forth, may have been caused by early humans hunting and using fire in drive hunts. And that's a fascinating thought, that maybe the global climate as we know it today is in many ways the result of activities of the small bands, 15, 20, 50 at a time, of people making up a global population of maybe a few millions 20 or 50,000 years ago. That's a really fascinating thought. But surely, fire all by itself gives us a very long lever. But atomic energy gives us a lever that's a million times as long. Humanity is possessed now of awesome powers, truly awesome powers. And I suppose the trouble is that in some ways, humanity today is like an infant in the sense of having enough power to severely injure itself and not yet having learned how not to do it. You know, your muscles, as a human being, ordinary human being, your muscles are actually strong enough to break your bones. In infancy, we learn not to do that. We learn to moderate our movements, and it becomes almost like a spinal reflex. It becomes utterly involuntary. And this is why children often seem to be unreasonably strong, is because they haven't quite yet learned how to moderate their muscular impulses so they don't break something. But fortunately, small children's bones are less calcified, and so if they do break something, it heals more rapidly. Anyway, so that's my thought of the day, perhaps. Or it would be my thought of the day if I didn't have a whole list of thoughts of the day for you. This is kind of crazy. I've got more thoughts of the day today than is at all normal. So somebody was talking about post-humanism. And I was thinking, well, what is a working definition of the post-human? Because on the one hand, you know, biology cannot and should not be denied or ignored, but we humans are biologically social. And so the life, the choices, the actions of the individual occur in a social context every bit as much as in a biological one. I'm not saying humans are socially determined in some Marxist sense, but I'm saying that our actions, our choices, and so on occur in a social context, and therefore we have to consider the capabilities of the social unit and not just those of the organism. Now, I've argued in the past, right, that in terms of singularity, right, in terms of radical change in human life, that writing, which allowed ideas to be preserved, was absolutely a fundamental change. And if you read Ong's Orality and Literacy, he goes into this quite a bit, how it actually changes the ways of thought to live in a literate society. But literacy, right, writing remained to be perfected by printing, because printing meant suddenly that written materials could be duplicated immense numbers of times and disseminated. It's one of the two necessities, really, for universal literacy. You know, you could have universal literacy in a society where there is no printing, but information will circulate much more slowly. I don't know. But then I've said before, the telephone and the phonograph, which both come on the scene right about 1876, suddenly the human voice can be heard at a distance, in space, or in time. That is a fundamental break with the past. And then I might suggest that there are two other harbingers of fundamental change. One of them, Edward Jenner's smallpox vaccine, which is the beginning of our ability not merely to prevent disease, but to alter biology directly. And then a man walking on the moon, which is the beginning of the cosmos as a direct part of human experience. And, you know, I said to somebody, you know, the thing is, I don't know if we can talk about post-humanism when there's a billion people who have never seen a light bulb. He says, well, I don't see what equality has to do with it. My response is, it's not equality. It's the fact that our actions occur in a social context. If we're looking at the capabilities of the social unit, the more capabilities every individual in that unit has, the more capabilities the unit itself has. Neil Armstrong wouldn't have walked on the moon in a society that didn't have near complete, near universal literacy. Neil Armstrong wouldn't have walked on the moon in a society that didn't have power farming, right? The capabilities of the social unit are the capabilities of the individuals heaped together. So the more power each individual has at his fingertips, the more capability the social unit has. So we really must talk about electricity for the whole world. We really must talk about a washing machine for every household. Or cluster, small cluster of households, but really. So I had this thought, right? So I already told you my thought for the day, that humanity is like an infant which hasn't yet learned to use its strength in ways that won't break its own bones. My second thought for the day, perhaps the post-human is not something that grows out of humanity, perhaps it is something that humanity grows into. How do you like that? And then my third thought for the day, which won't surprise anybody, is to say that opposing the peaceful uses of atomic energy is at least tacitly promoting continued reliance on fossil fuels as the key component in world energy supply. The resultant social and environmental pressures are the biggest presently foreseeable threat of nuclear war. All the people who oppose atomic energy on the grounds that it's somehow inimical to peace. No! God, no! It's oil! coal, gas, but especially oil, that are inimical to peace. We've already had a nuclear war fought over oil, right? The war between the United States and Japan in the 1940s, which is the only war in which nuclear weapons have yet been used, thanks be to God, was a war over oil. But yeah, somebody the other day on Mastodon, a German, naturally, it's always a German, told me that I must be crazy or lying to say that nuclear fuel waste can be kept under control for a time longer than civilization. Again, all I have to say is, have you been taking stupid pills? I don't know where he gets his facts. Certainly not from any of the extensive scientific studies which have been done on the subject. Because once you bury something, the question basically becomes one of geology, and geologists think on much longer time spans. We have perfect confidence that burial in salt or clay can keep the migration of radionuclides slow enough that they don't reach any place they're accessible by humans unless people actively go and dig in the salt or clay deposit involved, within the time that it takes the radionuclides to decay away to insignificance. And that's even if we do no pretreatment. If we take the fuel, recycle it into a reactor, segregate out the 1 to 5% of fission products, take those fission products, cast them into glass, cast the glass into stainless steel containers. Those containers by themselves would suffice to hold the fission products until the toxicity hazard is, from any reasonable standpoint, gone. And then if you bury them in clay or salt. You know, we have slightly less confidence in bedrock, granite, for example, which was the option the Swedish settled on because they have so much of it. They published inexplicably the report of their scientific expert committee was published in English in the format of a children's picture book entitled Can We Depend on Bedrock, which lays out in children's picture book illustrations and text that ought to be understandable to anyone who's reached the age of 20, certainly, probably have no difficulty at the teenage level. Probably a bright 10-year-old would understand it perfectly well, the reasons behind the conclusions. It mystifies me that this was ever published, but I have a copy of it. Of course, the same person also told me that you don't need to store 30% of annual production if you're in a country like Germany, which is well north of the equator, and you depend heavily on solar power. He says you only need a few days, and that can be provided by dams. I said dams, unlike nuclear plants, do actually occasionally fail and kill tens of thousands of people. It happened twice in the 1970s, once in China, the River Rue disaster, and again in India, the Matcha disaster in Gujarat in 1978. The official death toll was only about 2,500 because of bodies were taken away faster than they could be registered. Most people estimate it was at least 25,000 dead from the collapse of a couple of dams that were mostly for agricultural irrigation. Similarly, the River Rue dams were mostly for agricultural irrigation. But dams are dangerous. They're damn dangerous. And also, you can't make much use of them unless you have the appropriate topography. And Germany doesn't have great topography for hydro, which is why it has a lot less hydro than France does. You know, France can depend on hydro for peaking. Germany has a much harder time depending on hydro for peaking, even if it's provided with nuclear and coal-burning baseload plants. To say that, oh, well, Germany could depend for several days on its dams and hydro, I doubt that's true. But the thing is, the guy says, well, you're in, you know, he also told me, there's absolutely no way that the wind just goes away for weeks at a time the way you're claiming. Calms, they happen. Several years ago, I've got a graph. Several years ago, the Bonneville Power Authority experienced a calm. I think they were down 20 days with no appreciable wind generation. Now, this is an important thing to understand. Because the power output of a wind machine varies with the cube of the wind speed, there is a wind level below which, a wind speed below which it doesn't generate anything. You may not think there's no wind, but if the wind is less than about 5 knots, the wind turbine doesn't see any wind. So just last summer, the island of El Hierro, in the Canary Islands, anyway, is it boasts of its 100% renewable energy, but for a considerable period in August, I think it was getting all of its electricity from diesel because of the wind falling off. Anybody who says there's no such thing as a calm, I don't know. I mean, I just don't understand it. I don't understand it at all. So there's a lot of folks out there who either there's something I'm not understanding or there's something they're not understanding. And I leave it to you, the listener, to make the judgment. It's possible that both are true, that there's something I don't understand about them and there's something they don't understand about the world that actually exists. Am I being rude about that? Let's see. I read that Elon Musk is trying to build a company town outside Austin for his Tesla and SpaceX and so on employees. I really think that's a bad idea. I think the reasons why it's a bad idea should be obvious. But the thing is, the way our laws work, he's not going to be able to set it up to do exactly what he wants. And for given the way he's been running Twitter, it seems like if he doesn't get exactly what he wants, he throws a temper tantrum and then breaks things. I don't like that kind of thing very much. Let's see. Japan's H3 launch vehicle, supposed to be the successor to the H2A, failed. The second stage apparently didn't ignite. Let's see. Also recently, India's SSLV, small satellite launch vehicle, succeeded on its second attempt in February. In June of last year, Korea's KSLV-2, South Korea's KSLV-2, succeeded on its second launch. Their original KSLV in 2013 used a lot of Russian components. This one is supposed to be, better. It's all domestic, or mostly domestic. I bet they have components from Mitsubishi. I bet they have components made in the U.S., but more domestic. And then Relativity Space's Terra 1 also succeeded on its second launch attempt. Liquid oxygen methane fuel, 80% additive manufacturing by mass. Additive manufacturing, of course, what people call 3D printing. So I'm sure a lot of the, you know, the sheet metal components are still sheet metal, but a lot of the other structural components, and probably the engine, are all done by 3D printing, which is pretty cool. Basically, we have both government and private space programs succeeding more and more, but it seems like nobody ever wins on the first launch. It seems like everybody is succeeding in getting something into orbit on the second launch. Which just goes to show that this stuff is genuinely hard. And even people who've been in the business a long time and they've done a lot of it have problems. So, but yes, I do think that the Europeans would be far better posed to say, hey, let's double the amount of nuclear power outside France by the year 2030. That's a reasonable and achievable goal, which will give a boost to economies rather than damaging them, rather than sending industry overseas, rather than increasing unrest due to unemployment, benefits cuts, and so on, which will only make things worse. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, where you can see various updates of my activities, and send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 103-5 Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States...